Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you want to download it or put it on your iPod or listen on your computer. Today, we have an excellent show. As e-discovery has become a more mature industry, I tend to run into attorneys who are starting to offer support within their law firms to other lawyers on e-discovery issues. And it's a new career path and one which offers more lawyers the ability to handle e-discovery matters without fumbling the ESI issues or frankly, opting out of e-discovery because it's foreign to them, even though that's where most of the evidence resides. So this is a new breed of lawyer that can enter the field from a number of different paths. Today, I have three attorneys who followed this path, each differently. And so today's topic is Becoming an e-Discovery Lawyer podcast. Okay, so Chris Fisher is the first person I talked to about doing this show, and he's a partner at Ulmer Byrne and based in Cleveland, Ohio. He's not a classic e-discovery attorney, as he was a partner before he began offering some support at his firm in e-discovery-related disputes. His practice has always been in business litigation. He represents companies and financial institutions in diverse commercial disputes. Yet when you have deeply rooted technology skills, other lawyers in your firm recognize that. So Chris on occasion has been asked to help by some of his litigator colleagues when they recognize cases have the potential for e-discovery issues. Therese Miller is of counsel with Chicardi and Bacon in their San Francisco, California office. And she's the more traditional e-discovery resource because she was a technology and systems analyst by training before she became an attorney. And in her practice, she advises clients on electronic data management, information law relative to electronic discovery, data security and privacy rights, records management, and legal technology. She's also been doing a good deal of speaking on Web 2.0 technologies and cloud computing. Therese is also a member of the Sedona Conference. The last panelist is, here in Pittsburgh alongside me here, Rick Letteri. He has a virtual law firm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which provides second chair support for lawyers in e-discovery cases. He's been a technologist and an attorney in e-discovery. He worked with IBM developing litigation support systems and published a book for the ABA in 1991, The Corporate Counsel's Guide to In-House Legal Systems. The book became a roadmap for development and use of corporate legal systems and established Rick as a legal systems thought leader, earning him a certificate of appreciation from the ABA in 1991. He has worked with Kroll on Track in the past as a legal consultant. For the past year, he's hung out a shingle and helped lawyers a second chair alternative to assist with complex electronic discovery issues. So you're all different. I thank you for joining us here on ESI Bytes.
And, you're welcome.
Yeah, so why don't we start out, Therese, I'll have you go first, and then Chris and Rick. Tell me how you started in electronic discovery, and also if you can let me know, do you think you can do a case e-discovery all by yourself?
Yes. The answer to that question is yes. I started e-discovery kind of by doing litigation first. And so I got my undergraduate degree, like you said in the introduction, in management information systems, and that made me kind of an IT person. And then when I went to law school, I continued to pay for law school by be acting as my university's webmaster. So I had a lot of web design background and computer technology education. And so when I started, I've been practicing for about 10 years, and when I started my practice, I started in products liability litigation. But of course, you know, like you said, if you're a technologist, you're usually dubbed as the technology person at the firm. And so on my teams with my clients, all the technology-related projects would go to me. And so my very first year as a lawyer, I developed a legal website, kind of an extranet for outside counsel for one of my big clients for a work product depository on e-discovery. And then kind of revolted against it, decided to continue in product liability litigation, still got all of the e-discovery projects, and then about 5 years in, I switched over to copyright litigation and did recording industry prosecution for about a year. So I was suing people for downloading music illegally for the recording industry. I did that for a year, and of course, everything involved in those cases is ESI. So it's electronically stored information that you're dealing with on every case. And then after a year of doing that, I switched over to intellectual property litigation, doing trademark defense work mostly. And then went in with a small group of lawyers doing e-discovery almost exclusively in the summer of 2008. And so I've been doing that ever since. And so I think that should answer your question.
Yeah. And by the way, you're the first person that can do it all by yourself that I've heard. But having said that, I guess if you have really strong technology skills and strong legal, that's a real advantage. Few people have that background in firms.
Well, and I guess, you know, if you mean actually processing the documents, I probably would hire someone. So I wouldn't want to do that one, that part by myself, even though I probably could.
Okay. Well, Chris, how about yourself?
Well, you know, in answer to your two-part question, I don't think I would do it by myself, but it's hard to know exactly what you mean by doing it by yourself, because as Teresa alluded to, there's processing that is really something that I think probably is most efficiently done by an outside vendor such as yourself. You know, certainly the management of it is something that that I can do and take the lead on here. You know, for me, evolving into e-discovery happened sort of automatically. It wasn't as though I ever planned it or was assigned that role. And I think two things really pushed me in that direction. One is my background. I came to the law a little later in life than most people. Before law school, I had various information technology-related roles in business, both on the supplier side and as a technology manager within a company. And that gave me a little bit of a leg up when it came to understanding e-discovery issues from a technical standpoint. Now, I'm not an engineer, but I at least have the experience and knowledge necessary to understand how clients are likely to have their information systems set up and organized. And the second was really just timing. You know, I started to develop a little bit of seniority at my firm at just about the time that e-discovery started to become a hot issue. You know, for a long time, I think that law firms and the courts were almost in denial as to this issue. And we were all sort of stuck in a 1950s paradigm about document discovery, even though the world had changed around us. And then it sort of happened suddenly. Everyone seemed to wake up to the fact that a half a century had passed and that the legal profession needed to change. And no one knew how to do it. And some courts were out there imposing really absurd burdens because they didn't understand, how IT worked. And others were completely ignoring the problem, and law firms were scrambling to figure out what to do. And I just happened to be in the position to learn the issues and help out within the firm.
Great. And Rick, yourself.
Yes, Carl, you indicated in the bio, I started back early on with IBM in a group called Legal Systems, working with our litigation support group in the large antitrust cases that IBM had back when. And as a result of that, I got involved with the use of technology, and we share that with our largest corporate accounts, their general counsel. And that's what led to to being asked and to publishing a book by American Bar Association. And interestingly, to correspond with the comments that Chris just made, it took almost two decades for the legal profession to adapt fully to the principles and applications that I outlined in that book. I predicted it would be 3 to 5 years after the PC was announced. It ended up taking probably 20 years, which is a testament to how long it takes some of these things to be adopted. But nevertheless, with the continued explosion of data in the 90s and early 2000s and the litigation issues raised by the revisions to the federal rules, it became clear that electronic evidence, ESI, e-discovery, was an area that required some help and that I should get back into. So about 5 years ago, I approached some executives at Kroll on track and began to work on complex litigation involving e-discovery with them. And a part of that role was to call on large corporations to determine their litigation preparedness in light of these new demands. And after doing that and talking with so many and hopefully helping some of them, I decided a year ago that I could probably best help both judges and lawyers if I were practicing on my own and offering my services as a second chair. So in answer to your question, I'd say no, probably not. I mean, I couldn't do everything myself. I work best in a team environment where I'm acting as an e-discovery specialist and advisor and hopefully adding some value in that effort.
Well, you've each got such unique backgrounds. Chris, why don't we start with you? Since you said you were at a more senior level when this hit, how did you evolve your practice, which was already well established as a commercial litigator, to also include electronic discovery?
Well, you know, like I said, it was sort of automatic. You start to encounter cases where e-discovery is an issue because you're dealing with complex cases and clients that have sophisticated IT departments, and you realize that you just have no choice, both on the offensive side and the defensive side. If you're going to respond appropriately to discovery and if you're going to identify the documents that you need to properly litigate a case, and for the on the offensive side, if you're going to get the documents that you're entitled to from the other side, you simply have no choice. You have to be able to deal with the electronic systems that are present at your client, and you have to understand how the electronic systems are likely to be maintained at your adversary, and you need to be able to structure requests and structure your responses so that you deal with it. It's something that happened automatically.
And Therese, are there any challenges that you see when you're working with other lawyers to help them with e-discovery, or are the challenges when they elect to go at it alone?
You know, and both of those things happen, especially when you're in a large firm. You know, some attorneys who are litigators will elect to go it alone, and then you were brought in to help them. I think when they elect to go it alone, they better not do it with a client that is represented by more than one person at the firm. And so, you know, I think with the bigger the client and the more complex the litigation, the more they have to bring in people who understand e-discovery issues. But I think the biggest challenge for e-discovery when working with lawyers to help them is the communication issue. And really, the first main thing that I notice in my practice is attorneys usually don't know what they want. And so if they're the ones, you know, brought in from the beginning, from the front end, in meet and confer and in, you know, initial disclosures, they don't know what they want, they don't know what they need, and they really need to do that really at the beginning of the case. And I find that after, you know, coming in, if I'm brought in kind of halfway through the case, you realize, you know, that they don't know how to communicate the technology questions. Because really, I mean, everything about e-discovery is fact gathering. And if you, you know, send your lawyers in and they're traditionally used to interviewing witnesses about, you know, substantive areas of the law, and then all of a sudden they come in and they can't understand the technology portions of it, it could become a competency issue. And so I noticed that the communication challenges really are between, you know, the lawyers and IT within the company, the client, or lawyers and in-house counsel. And sometimes in-house counsel, if they're not asked the right questions, they may not tell you what's actually out there, even if, you know, the facts are there. And so you want to make sure that they can communicate with in-house counsel. Sometimes, you know, the legal department isn't communicating with other departments within the company, and so that's another issue. You know, you want to make sure that IT and records management and maybe compliance, as well as the legal department, are all communicating about a case, because someone might put, you know, documents on legal hold and then the rest of the company doesn't know what's going on and deleting files as a matter of course. And then lastly, I would say the biggest communication issue is with opposing counsel. you know, you want to make sure that you're objecting properly to the requests that are being asked, and then also that your briefing makes technological sense.
Okay. And Rick, your challenges might be greater than the others because you have to sell lawyers on the utility of having you on their team. What do you see as the biggest challenges with the clients you're trying to work with?
Well, I'd have to say the biggest challenge, Carl, is one kind of a subset of what Teresa just indicated, and that is helping lawyers understand the complexities involved. In other words, just how complex this is. I found that, you know, lawyers generally bright, intelligent folks, big egos in some cases, think that after reading a little bit about technology, sometimes they can deal with some of these issues, which, of course, we know are a little more complex than they seem on the surface. So that's the probably the biggest challenge. But associated with that, then, of course, is showing them that I can help reduce costs and I'm not an additional layer of costs in helping them try to avoid what's become a war of motions in discovery or e-discovery if it's not dealt with initially up front. As Teresa mentioned in a prior to the Rule 26F meet and confer, and of course that is best done cooperatively, which is the reason behind the Sedona Conference proclamation on cooperation. It's been signed by so many federal judges now. So the complexities involve the idea that I'm there to help reduce costs by preventing a war of motions and helping them solve these issues cooperatively up front, I'd say, are my major challenges.
You know, since I'm listening here, I've heard, Therese, you say that the biggest problems appear to be the communication issue of what lawyers need to ask for right up front. And Rick, you've talked about the complexities. Chris, where do you see the biggest problem for non-tech lawyers? Do you have anything else to add in there?
Well, I'm not sure I have that much to add to that. I do see the biggest problem, I think, for the non-technical lawyer is understanding the way that data and documents are maintained both at the client and potentially at the adversary. Because what you've got is you've got all sorts of different possible IT structures, and you need to understand something about how that's put together so you know whether you're looking where you need to look and whether you're in fact getting the documents from the other side that you're supposed to be getting. So it's communicating generally but also specifically about how is IT set up so that you know where to look for documents.
Yeah, and I suppose you can't put a good litigation hold in place if you don't have a sense of where the data might be.
Well, that's for sure.
Well, Chris, you have an interesting sort of hybrid here. Do you maintain your other practice areas, or is e-discovery really starting to take over?
Well, yeah, e-discovery is not a specialty for me at all. We don't view it as a specialty at my firm. I mean, I'm a general business litigator, and I do complex business litigation. That's what I do for a living. Now, discovery, obviously, is part of every litigation matter, and nowadays, discovery pretty much always includes e-discovery. And that means that, in my view, and I may differ from Teresa and Rick on this, in my view, every litigator, at least every litigator involved in complex business cases, has to be competent in dealing with e-discovery issues. You just have to. And so in response to your question, no, e-discovery has not taken over my practice at all. At my firm, at Ulmer & Byrne, we think that everybody needs to be competent in e-discovery, and every significant piece of litigation is going to have somebody on the team who can handle e-discovery effectively.
And, Teresa, I mean, that's the nice thing about sort of federalism. Everyone attacks us different ways, and there are different types of cases. You're in sort of a more of a department, Teresa, around e-discovery. What's a typical way you're brought into a case to help with ESI?
Well, I think, you know, typically we're brought in if there's, you know, a request for discovery, for e-discovery or some sort of discovery production request that involves electronic information or data. And so we usually get brought in after meet and confer, And then sometimes we're brought in if, you know, the court orders enters a preservation order, or if there's a motion to compel electronic data. And then sometimes if there's a data breach or some sort of, you know, data or information crisis, we're brought in kind of at the last minute to try to mitigate those issues, which is not always the most wise way to be to be brought into a case. And so what we always try to kind of emphasize with the attorneys at the firm in the larger scheme of things is that we should be brought in at information management point. We do a lot of consultation with clients about how to manage their records and data on the front end so that when litigation actually occurs, there's no crisis situation. But unfortunately, you know, crises do happen, and we get brought in for those as well.
So it sounds like almost there's some similarities with Chris's practice in that at the meet and confer, at least, all commercial litigators have some sense of what's going on. And then it's as you start dealing with the technology, you're brought in.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and if I could add to that, you know, part of it too is you've got to communicate with the technical folks, both at the client, and if the client isn't sophisticated in terms of technology, then you maybe need to bring in somebody from outside to help you analyze where the client is technologically. And you do need to be proactive about that.
And this is Therese. And also to add what you're talking about, bringing someone in from the outside, we will sometimes even hire a technology expert specifically to come in and analyze the specific systems involved and give the court a testimony on whether or not a discovery request is feasible.
Boy, that, I tell you, that seems to be one growth area. I mean, we're seeing that a bit at Jurnov right now. So,
we do that a lot.
Now, Chris, in your practice, if you sort of, now looking at you in the support role where an attorney says, hey, I need some help here because I see technology, I know your background, how does that differ, that engagement from managing your own caseload?
Well, for me, supporting other attorneys on technical issues is more of an informal thing. It would be unusual for me to be brought into a case that's already in progress solely to deal with technological issues or e-discovery issues, because as I said, we view that as something that is part of every litigation or typically part of most cases. And so we would staff a case so that there would be somebody on board who would be able to handle that. But there are smaller cases or cases that are leanly or thinly staffed because they it's appropriate to do it that way. And in some cases, then I will come in and assist. But it would be on an ad hoc basis rather than a permanent sort of member of the team. Another role, though, that where I can help out is to bring developing issues to the attention of the business litigation group, so that our collective competence remains high. I mean, technology is changing very quickly, and there's a real need to keep up to date, and that's one of the ways that I can help out in the firm.
Well, Rick, you have a different type of background here, and what's your typical role in a case as a second chair lawyer? I mean, how would you describe how your engagements go?
Yeah, interestingly, I think Chris hit on the point where it's usually recognized that my skills are required. It usually comes in the preparation, of the 26F meet and confer issues relative to ESI. And that involves, of course, being able to find out information about the IT architecture and procedures prior to coming to that meeting. So, for instance, I would be, as a plaintiff's co-counsel, I would conduct 30B6 depositions of IT personnel of the defendant to find out where the data resides, what type of architectures used, how their email systems are, what types of database they use, and all the information I need to determine where the data is and whether it's accessible or inaccessible due to undue burden of cost, what format it's in, and answering all the issues raised by the Rule 26F. If I'm a defense counsel, I'll of course be conducting those interviews of the client's IT staffs very similarly, but I won't have to do it in a formal 30B6 type deposition. And then, of course, from all that, once we understand all that, then I'm often asked to write specific and very targeted e-discovery document requests or answer them, fully satisfying Rule 26G requirement for reasonable inquiry, which has become even more important, as we all know, based on the recent Mancia Mayflower case. That's typically, Carl, what I've been doing, but I've seen a trend occurring, and that being that as judges deal more with this issue and are dissatisfied generally with the extent of some of the preparation done prior to the meet and confer, they've begun to appoint e-discovery special masters to go in and help sort things out and help the parties and the counsel deal with these issues. So last year alone, I was asked three times for recommendations for special masters, and here in Western District of Pennsylvania, as you know, there's a committee afoot which I've been asked to provide some information regarding the qualifications and requirements of an e-discovery special master, because the judges have clearly indicated that that's a direction that they want to take here in Western District. But also nationally, there have been many judges, Judge Shinlin being one of them, in a recent Cardozo Law Review article with Jonathan Redgrave that outlined the uses of special masters and why they believe there'll be more of them being used in the future.
Therese, I want to get to one of your themes that you were talking about the fireman call. You know, last minute, things are blowing up. Can you help, you know, ride in and fix things? You know, what are the challenges there? You know, let's sort of define that as maybe the wrong way of doing it. And, talk to me a little bit about why that's so problematic.
Well, and I think, really it's just a matter of getting as much information about what went wrong in that situation as possible in a very short period of time. So you kind of say, okay, what exactly, you know, is the motion to compel or the motion for sanctions, you know, implying, and how can we mitigate this by finding out exactly what happened? Sometimes it's, you know, one, you know, in-house counsel not talking to out-house counsel or outside counsel, or, you know, just a lack of communication on that side. But then it also can be us actually doing the briefing and, you know, coming in with the legal arguments that I think, you know, most litigators are pretty well aware a lot of the issues that are coming along in e-discovery, but I think it was Chris who mentioned, you know, bringing up new issues that are, you know, developing in this area, you know, and how to mitigate a crisis situation. Sometimes it's educating the judge.
And you raise an interesting point, Chris, you did as well, about, you know, being sort of the repository of new information. Is part of that involved mentoring younger lawyers to develop additional support within your firm in this area? Because, you know, younger people seem to play with technology more and more. Is that a part of your role? I guess, Therese, I'll start with you, but I'd like your opinion as well, Chris.
I think that's definitely true, and it's definitely nice to see, you know, some of the younger lawyers who just graduated law school and have a lot more understanding and a little bit less apprehension towards technology when it comes to discovery. I mean, they automatically assume that you would look into the computer files for the evidence, whereas, you know, some older attorneys might be a little bit more hesitant, or, you know, do the general boilerplate objection without being reasonable. And so I think it's a little bit of a breath of fresh air with younger attorneys when it comes to their level of competency. But what's frustrating, I think, when I mentor younger attorneys is to try to explain to them why the law really hasn't caught up with the technology. I mean, most of the time, you know, we're dealing with a little bit kind of, you know, several steps behind when it comes to the law and how the case law is developing with regard to the technology, when the reality is completely different.
Just give him Rick's book from 91.
And that was Rick's point. You know, it took, what, 20 years? That's, I think, a big reality right now.
And Chris, do you see this mentoring of young lawyers as part of what you try to offer at your firm?
Sure. And, you know, to echo what Teresa said, I think that a lot of certainly people coming out of law school today and recently are a lot more used to dealing with technology on a day-to-day basis. But on the other hand, if you don't have some understanding of the nuts and bolts, sometimes the computers and the communications, they're very facile as users, but maybe not as sophisticated as we sometimes think in terms of looking beyond what you see on the screen and just using the machine. And that's something that that we all need to think about is, what's behind this machine and how is it storing data and where is it keeping it and how do we find it? And that's not always something that's automatically understood.
And, I'm looking at your three backgrounds. I'm thinking about them. So, I might want each of you to weigh in on this. But Rick, do you think we're going to get to a day when lawyers everywhere have enough competence to handle ESI, just like they've handled paper for years? If so, I guess, what do you do with your virtual firm and what's Therese do? Chris, I think you're probably okay because you're preparing for this. But you know, do you think that's on the horizon?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, Carl, and I think I go back to...
Well, you got a pension from IBM, so you're okay.
Well, I believe that lawyers will eventually become ESI competent, and I think Chris indicated that that's the way his firm is going, and he's actually seen that. It's become, or it has to become, a core competency. I don't think that's happened yet, and I don't think it will happen overnight, based on my experience as I indicated with the book I wrote, so long ago. But I think we're in the midst of a transition that's probably 10 to 20 years in length. And just to highlight that, who can believe it's been 6 years since the Zubelik opinion? So we're 6 years into it. I think we've got another 14 or 15 to go. And eventually, though, I think it has to become a core competency. And that the need for, and I think that right now some e-discovery co-counsel specialists like myself can help speed that knowledge transfer. But eventually it will become a core competency. It's just a question of when. I think firms that speed to it quickly will put themselves in an advantageous position. As to your second question, Carl, I'll defer that to the younger panelists because, as you indicated, if it takes 20 years, I plan to be retired by then, and I won't have to deal with your second question.
Therese, you're in the hot spot. You're the most to lose here, it sounds like. So what's your thought?
I think Rick is right. I think it'll become a core competency. I mean, you see it happening. I think, at least from an outside counsel perspective at a big firm, the clients are driving the requirement that attorneys know the law and know the technology. And so, like at our firm, for example, our professional development committee has a requirement for young associates that they have a certain level of technical expertise when it comes to operating, law firm equipment and using the technology. And so I think that just, translates over into their practice when they're on the litigation side. But, really e-discovery, all e-discovery is conducting discovery in litigation. And so I don't think litigation will go away. And so I think I'll be employed for a very long time.
Okay. And I'm just going to mention one thing, because this doesn't often happen. But I'm reading the back of a shirt, which I've just now taken off, which you can do in a home office, okay? But I handed out these shirts to EED All-Stars, I called them, which was from a panel I did in Miami, I think. And I had Kevin Esposito, Jim Michowitz, I think Jonathan Redgrave might have even been in this panel. But it was an EED All-Stars, a critical explorer of the, quote, bums rush aspects of EED, who has participated in an EED Discovery All-Star panel or an EED Discovery article, might also be a drinker of my 4C wine, which is EED Discovery wine. Collectively, the EED Discovery All-Stars hope to identify better practices to show how technology tools and people from different organizations can be united to make eDiscovery projects more efficient. Exercises while not gaining too much efficiency to put any of us eDiscovery All-Stars out of a job. And, you know, we're not there yet, so which is sort of good. But you know, it is interesting how we you know, that was, I think, 5 years ago when we were all wearing these shirts at a conference, and it does take a long time. The one question I just thought of, though, was, we've all been talking about big firms, and you're all members of big firms. Rick, you're not. You know, what's happening with the smaller firms? You know, a lot of this education is hitting larger clients and large firms. Do you think they're ever going to get a handle on this?
I can speak to that, maybe a little bit. I think it depends on the types of cases that are going on in the smaller firms. I think if, depending on the type of practice, if they're litigating, you know, divorce cases and things like that, I do think that eventually electronic discovery is going to, you know, specifically affect them. But, you know, small firms can get competencies in eDiscovery even though they're smaller firms. And the rules equally apply to them right now, even though I think there is a push for electronic discovery reform for the solo practitioner and small law firms, and for the small clients, because of the burdens they see these rules, and they basically think that the rules only apply to big firms and big clients.
Carl, this is Rick. On that point, I've seen an interesting development that I think hits to your question. And that is, I think that the people most at risk right now are the small firms and the solo practitioners who are up against larger firms with e-discovery resources and experience that they've gained through complex litigation. So for those folks, they are in the need to try to level that playing field by augmenting their team with e-discovery counsel who can augment their skills and level the playing field against firms with larger resources and e-discovery competency. So I think there is a need, and I think that it's being recognized by that group of lawyers.
And then let me direct this to you, Chris. But, you know, as we're sort of wrapping this up here at the end, do you have any advice for attorneys who have a technical background or an interest in e-discovery and how to develop this practice for themselves?
Well, sure. You know, I think that if you're at a larger firm like I am and like Teresa is, you need to just develop your basic competency as part of the whole litigator package. But if you're at a smaller firm or you're interested in doing something completely unique, sort of like Rick is, I do think there's a market out there for it. I think you can become, in a smaller firm, the go-to person on e-discovery issues, and you know, if you have a technical background and have an interest, then you can become an expert in it. Now, I don't see it as a separate practice area within a large firm, but I do think there's a market for it in smaller firms, and I also think that in larger firms, becoming sort of an expert in it can definitely help a young lawyer's career going forward. You know, things change very rapidly in technology today, and they're going to continue to change. And I think there's always going to be a role for somebody who's on top of this kind of an issue.
Okay. Therese, do you always have an opinion? Have anything to add there?
Sure. I think, you know, I completely agree with Chris's statement to develop the core competency as a litigation package. I mean, I don't think you can understand, even if with a technical background, I think you have to understand litigation in order to understand how to respond to litigation requests in the course of discovery. And so, you know, what I find with young attorneys, you know, when you're dealing with e-discovery issues, for example, they may be discussing a technical issue that they understand, but they don't understand, or they've never attended a meet and confer or a deposition or, you know, responded to discovery. And so they definitely should develop the litigation understanding before going into trying to kind of become an expert in the e-discovery area. But once you kind of develop that competency, I think you can definitely, you know, specialize in this area, start attending Sedona Conference and other groups that kind of focus on these issues and get an understanding by just reading and kind of getting up to speed on these particular areas.
Now, Therese, you mentioned the Sedona Conference. I'll ask you, Rick, and then Chris. Outside of listening to ESI Bytes, what do you do to stay current in e-discovery?
Well, first, Carl, let me say that I have listened to some of the ESI Bytes, and I've been very impressed with the prior sessions you've had, especially one, as I think I mentioned, with Judge Shinlin out of Southern District of New York, Jonathan Redgrave. I think there's a lot of value to be gained by going back and listening to all of them. I'm about through a third of them, I think, at this point.
Yeah, I have no choice. I've listened to all of them.
You were there. But I do think that's one way. But in addition to that, I think clearly I'm investing approximately 5 hours a week just trying to keep up on the court cases, the articles. And I've also taken a very active role speaking and writing on this topic. I've had an opportunity to co-author several articles with federal judges on a number of topics and speak. And that, of course, forces you to delve deeply into various and specific topics. So yes, I think we have to continue to stay current by reading, and by participating to the extent we can in discussions of this type.
And Chris, for yourself.
Well, of course, doing the same things that Rick and Teresa mentioned are key, and that's probably 98% of it. But the only other thing I would mention is, pay attention to developments in technology generally. And I'll give you a couple of examples. I mean, one is email, for me, is, of course, and I think for most of us, a dominant form of business communication today. And when we think of e-discovery, oftentimes that's primarily what we're thinking of. But my kids and a lot of the folks coming out of law school today, I mean, they don't use email as much. They text each other on their cell phones, and they post things on each other's Facebook pages. Now, you ask yourself, is business communication done that way? Well, you know what? It's starting to be. And, you have to figure out where those text messages are and how you're going to get those. We haven't had to deal with that before, but we do now. And another issue is, movement away from servers that are owned and operated by individual companies and toward, and I think Teresa may have written about this, cloud computing. Well, we're going to have to deal with that. And keeping on top of, not from a technical engineering standpoint, but just from a standpoint of how are people using technology out there in the world, keeping on top of that, I think, is critical.
Yeah, that's a good way to end this. And I appreciate all of you joining us. And that was a good answer, Chris. It's hard to go third. Three people panels are a little rough when I go around the table here. But, I want to thank Therese, Chris, and Rick for joining us on another show. It's always a pleasure to have each of you share your knowledge with us and our listeners. And hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com. That's ESI Bytes. For a complete list of our show, you can remember it phonetically because it's easy bytes. That's what it sounds like. That's the way it's spelled. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about e-discovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Jurnov, wishing you a nice day.